away at Marion's hair, parting and smoothing. "It's no good," she said. "I need a comb and some brilliantine. Wait a minute." Alone in the kitchen, Marion listened to Belle's footsteps retreat up the stairs. She heard a distant murmur of voices. A pot on the stove gave off oniony steam. Beside the stove, a door led to the basement stairs, and this opened. Mrs. Wu came in. She was very thin, with a small round face and hair shot through with gray. She glanced at Marion without surprise, crossed to the stove and stirred the stew with a wooden spoon. Then she drew a few bills from the pocket of her apron and handed them over, saying, "From Miss Dolly," before she disappeared back down to the basement. Footsteps tumbled chaotically from above. Belle burst into the kitchen. "Come upstairs. No one's here but a couple girls. We'll do you over, dress you up, just for fun. What do you say? Say yes." "Yes," Marion said. Stanley's truck could wait. She only had a few more stops to make. "Good." Belle dug a bottle out from under the custard tart. 2 inches of moon went into a tumbler. She topped off the bottle with water, corked it, nestled it back in place. Upstairs, Belle pulled Marion along a dark hallway. She shoved open a door into a cramped box of rosy light. A pink scarf over a lamp, pink wallpaper spun through with roses and lilies. Cora lay on her stomach on an unmade bed in a robe, reading a book with her ankles up and crossed. A girl who called herself Desiree was sitting at a vanity in her step-ins, tiny but plump. Her face puckered tight like a bud, black hair loose down her back as she brushed it. There was barely room for all of them. Bits of lace and silk dangled like vines from the drawers of a small dresser. "Whatever shall we do with her?" Belle said about Marion. They set upon her, had her clothes off in a heartbeat. They were used to nakedness and were not bothered, so neither was she, though they laughed at her for wearing boys' drawers. Belle took a gulp of moon and handed the tumbler to Desiree, who drank and handed it to Cora, who passed the dregs to Marion, who swallowed them. When she was younger, before Caleb started cutting her hair, she'd often swum naked with him and Jamie. But while that had had a prelapsarian purity, this felt like a ritual stripping down, an assumption of blankness. She clutched her money pouch against her bare chest. "You think we're after your money?" said Desiree. "Pardon me while I laugh." "I can't lose it, that's all." "We make our own money."
"How much?"
"Depends. More than you, I bet."
Theirs was a form of income Marion had never considered. Gilda, Caleb's mother, always seemed dirt poor, but who knew how she'd fare without the booze?
"Getting ditties, aren't you, finally?" said Cora. Irish accent. "Where?" said Desiree. "I don't see any."
"They're there," said Cora. "Fetch your magnifying glass."
To Marion, she said, "Are you bleeding yet?" Marion, for all her reading, had no idea what the girl meant. And so it was from a prostitute in a room pink as a block of rose quartz that she learned about the monthly curse, which sounded like a curse indeed, the way Cora told it, her explanation tinged with the horror of lost income. Garbed in a black slip of Desiree's and an ivory peignoir, in stockings and garters and shoes with a strap and heel, Marion stared at herself in the vanity while the girls brilliantined her hair and powdered her face and kohled her eyes and rubbed in rouge with their thumbs.
"Does it hurt?"
"Not really," said Belle. "Some girls get terrible belly aches. And you have to watch out because once you get it, you can get knocked up. You know what that means, don't you?" Marion knew. "But if it happens, you come see us and Mrs. Wu will sort you out."
"Sort me out how?"
"A little too much dragon smoke," said Desiree, "and a bit of a scrape." She perched on the vanity, grasped Marion's chin. "Mrs. Wu used to be one of Miss Dolly's girls. She started a sideline in keeping everyone out of trouble."
But then she got married? Marion asked, wondering about Mr. Wu. The girls laughed. Desiree said, "Open your mouth just a bit." A red lipstick made the circuit of Marion's lips. Desiree leaned back to inspect her. "Could be worse." Marion's reflection showed a vaguely familiar person. The whites of her eyes seemed unnaturally bright within their coal moats. Her freckles were lost under paint and powder. Her face seemed both soft and hard, its planes sharp but not yet set all the way. "What do I do now?" "Now we sell you to the highest bidder," said Cora, squeezing the bulb of a perfume bottle, sending a fragrant mist onto Marion's sternum. "Lots of gents out there looking for someone just like you. How old are you anyway?"
14 and a half.
"That's older than I was when I started. You're a virgin still."
"How much would I get?"
"You oughtn't," Belle said. "Not you."
"There's money in it," said Cora.
"You're setting yourself as inspiration," Desiree said. Cora looked peeved.
"I'm not sharing a room with 8 brothers and sisters anymore, am I? Not living next to a stockyard that smells of shit."
"Now," Belle said to Marion, "put your hand on your hip like this and say, 'Hiya, mister. Need a date?'"
"Hiya, mister," Marion said solemnly. "Need a date?"
The girls fell all over themselves, laughing.
"Date to a funeral, maybe, you ask like that," said Desiree.
"Sit like this," Cora said, arching her back and looking over her shoulder, "and say, 'No twat like this one.'"
Marion obeyed, blushing, goaded by their laughter, the dirty word, the glimpses of herself in the mirror.
The doorbell, loud and resounding, startling them into silence.
"Just when we were having a laugh," Cora said.
Belle said, "No one had an appointment."
"They don't need an appointment," said Cora.
They heard the muffled sounds of Mrs. Wu letting someone in.
"Damn."
Desiree had sprung to her feet, begun to root through a drawer.
"It's for me, I forgot."
"Cora can go," said Belle.
"No, it's Barclay McQueen, he's choosy."
"Why, thanks very much," said Cora.
"Not like that, just, he likes everything just so.
Go down there, Belle, and stall for a minute. Cora, help me put my hair up."
"It's Barclay McQueen?" said Marion.
Cora was already twisting Desiree's hair back from her face.
"Know him?"
"I know who he is."
"Take the kid," Desiree said to Belle, screwing a red bullet of lipstick up out of its tube.
Marion grabbed her clothes off the floor.
"Come on,"
Belle said, trying to tug her along.
"I have to get down there. Dolly will be furious if he leaves."
"I feel strange going down like this."
Belle eyed her.
"Let's see what he does when he sees you."
"I can't," Marion said, dragging backward.
Belle pulled her by the arm.
"Just as a lark, it'll be funny. You'll see. They can't help themselves. Say the bit about your twat. I dare you. I'll give you a whole cream puff."
Downstairs, Belle grabbed Marion's clothes out of her hands and tossed them into the dark front parlor before she passed briskly through a swinging door to the back parlor. Marion hung behind, leaning against the wainscoting in the hall. Through the door, she glimpsed the crossed legs of a seated man, a polished black shoe tipping at the end of an elegant ankle.
A shoe, not a boot, despite the snow.
The door closed. The hallway was dark except for one electric wall sconce. Belle said rather grandly,
"Terribly sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. McQueen. Desiree will be just one more minute."
A low voice. "I'm told patience is a virtue, and this is a house of virtue, isn't it?" Marion had known Barclay McQueen's name since she'd started driving for Stanley. A rancher, in theory, from up north. His father, a Scotsman, had made himself one of the first cattle barons in the state, back before there was even need of fences. His mother was Flathead Salish. When misfortune put local moonshiners or bootleggers out of business, a raid or an explosion or an intercepted shipment, it was Barclay McQueen's name, they whispered. The feds had busted old Potshot not long before, destroyed his still and a dozen other rinky-dink stills around Missoula, and rumor was they'd been tipped off as part of their bargain with Barclay McQueen. Mr. Stanley didn't know how much longer he could hope to be spared. They said Barclay McQueen knew every trick in the book. He brought booze over the line by automobile, rail, mule, horse, backpack, canoe. He had operations in every town in Montana and more in Washington and Idaho and the Dakotas. He owned more speakeasies and cordial shops and roadhouses than you could count. His payroll was crowded with cops, lawyers, feds, train crews, councilmen, congressmen, judges, all their bookkeepers. He had liquor warehoused everywhere from mine shafts to church cellars to actual warehouses. They said his thousands of cattle and his massive landholdings weren't more than a hobby. They said most of the people who worked for Barclay McQueen didn't even know it.
If virtue's what you're after, we'll find it, Bell said, overly vivacious. Anything for you, Mr. McQueen.
Maybe another day. Will Desiree be ready soon?
I'll just go check.
Bell burst out of the room and bustled past Marion, giving an exaggerated shrug.
Bell, Marion whispered, what am I supposed to do?
Bell stopped halfway up the stairs, leaned over the banister to whisper back,
say hello, tell him you're thinking of going on the game.
Bell was only mocking, but Marion, nettled, thought, why not? Why shouldn't she fund her flying off men's lust? She thought again of Gilda, remembered the beast. A grandfather clock at the end of the hall marked the seconds with a sound like a tongue clicking in disapproval. Marion could have ducked into the front parlor, put her overalls back on, and left. But curiosity immobilized her. She heard an impatient rustle, shoes hitting the floor, a few footsteps, and the door was pulled open. What did Barclay see? A long, thin creature caught in the spill of light. Pale blue eyes ringed black, a fragile neck, stockings bagging slightly where there wasn't enough leg to fill them, black patent shoes like hooves below narrow ankles. A gleaming ivory cap of hair wrapped around a small head. Slender wrists, long fingers. He saw her startle. He saw fear and then a flare of something, something in her gaze like bared teeth. Defiance. He did not recognize her as a child. Why should he have expected to see a child here? He had been thinking of Desiree, had knots and heat inside him. What did Marion see? An elegant man in a black suit, cuffs white and starched, gold watch chain across a black waistcoat, black hair barbered precisely and glossy with oil. He had a broad Salish nose, full lips, firmly rounded cheeks pin-pricked with freckles. His complexion was olive, his eyes dark blue. He was not quite handsome. His eyes were too low in his face, his jaw heavy like a fighting dog's. She saw him see her, sensed how the sight of her arrested him.
Who are you? He said.
Bell was coming back down the stairs with Desiree, who had on a modest cream-colored dress over whatever arrangement of straps and frills were underneath. Marion slid away along the wall, and Barclay followed. She had been foolish to think she could ever do what Bell and the others did. A silly child, all dressed up.
Who are you? He said again.
Helplessly, she looked at Bell, who appeared to be trying to squelch the giggles. She could not say she was herself, Marion Graves, not when she was done up like this, not when he was looking at her that way. There was no answer.
She's just a kid, Desiree said, taking Barclay's arm. She's not one of ours.
He didn't shake her off, but he didn't respond to her touch either. He was still looking at Marion. Belle was looking at her too, biting her lip, eyes teary with mirth. Desiree looked furious. Their faces cornered her like hounds around a fox.
"Shall we?"
Desiree said, her voice rising. He yielded, followed. Marion pressed back against the wall, turned her face away as he passed, caught the smell of his hair oil and some other fragrance, slightly bitter. She was not used to perfumed men. His step slowed. She knew he was willing her to look up into his face, but she would not. "She's just a kid," Desiree said again. "Marion, you go home."
"Marion," he repeated.
Still, she did not look up. Not until Barclay and Desiree had finally climbed the stairs and a door had closed. Belle was doubled over with laughter.
"You're in trouble," she said, gasping. "Oh, Lord."
Marion darted into the front parlor, feverishly shed the robe and slip, the stockings and shoes.
"What trouble?"
She pulled her shirt and overalls back on, stepped into her boots but didn't bother tying them, bolted past Belle into the kitchen to retrieve her coat and muffler and the empty baskets. Mrs. Wu turned from the stove, took in Marion's painted face first with surprise, then with dismay.
"No," she said, shaking her head. "No good."
Marion was home before the snow started in earnest. She went upstairs to wash her face. The soap stung her eyes, but no matter how she scrubbed, she couldn't get rid of the last traces of coal. Barrett had made a chicken pie that Marion ate in silent agitation. For Jamie, there were boiled carrots and onions, as Barrett was still trying to punish him into eating meat. Wallace was out somewhere. Jamie was telling her about going up Mount Jumbo that afternoon. "I didn't see any elk. All I did was this." He opened his sketchbook to a drawing of a squirrel scaling a tree trunk. The charcoal lines were spare but sure, and Marion felt the roughness of the bark, the splay of the tiny claws, the shimmy of the scrabbling body. Through a mouthful of pie, she said,
"Do you know anything about Barclay McQueen?"
"You'd know more than I would," he said.
Marion knew he worried about her job, though he liked that they now had money to buy treats and movie tickets. For Christmas, she had given him a pair of field glasses and a watercolor set.
"Why?"
"I met him, sort of. I ran into him."
She wanted to explain how some disturbance had moved through the air between them, rolling off him, breaking against her. But she knew in describing it, she would make the encounter seem like nothing, or like too much.
"Where?"
"Miss Dolly's."
He flushed. "It doesn't look right, you going into places like that."
"No one sees me. Not unless they're already there, in which case they shouldn't be on any high horses."
"People talk." She looked up.
"What do they say?"
"That you work for a moonshiner."
"That's true, anyway."
"What is that around your eyes? You look like a raccoon."
Savagely, she scraped up the last of her chicken pie. He wouldn't have understood, even if she could have explained. She said,
"I don't care what they say."
Great white flakes, big as moths, were swooping and fluttering when she went out to the cottage. She tried to read, but she kept floating out of herself. Back to Miss Dolly's. Sitting in the armchair, she was perfectly still, but the memory of Barclay McQueen wound through her like a serpent. She put on her coat and went out again into the night, the snow. As she made her way toward Caleb's cabin, wading through the snow, her heart was beating so hard she could feel her pulse jumping in her neck. A blurred thrumming surrounded her, invisible hummingbird wings. But his window was dark, and when she tapped on the glass, he didn't come. Missoula, May to July, 1929.
2 months after Marion met Barclay McQueen.
One Sunday morning, Jamie was dozing in his cot, enjoying the cool early breeze in his hair and the sunshine slanting onto his blanketed legs, when the dogs sprang up barking and pushed out through the screen door, bustling to greet Wallace, who was walking up the driveway. Jamie watched Wallace stagger through the swirl of animals without seeming to notice them, as a man intent on drowning himself might plow heedlessly through the waves. His collar was open. His hat was pushed back on his head. He'd gone out the night before in the car, so he must have run out of gas somewhere or driven into a ditch. On such mornings, he was unpredictable. He might wordlessly retreat to bed and not emerge until dinner, or he might regale Jamie with lengthy, jolly, disjointed tales, or he might complain bitterly about some small injustice at the card table, or he might beg forgiveness for some obscure offense or some combination. There was no telling. Wallace yanked open the screen door and collapsed on Marion's cot, releasing a stale gust of sweat and booze. One dog slipped through with him, but the others were trapped outside and milled around, whining, until Jamie got up to let them in.
"Where's your sister?" Wallace asked.
He didn't sound as drunk as he looked. "Driving for Stanley?" Jamie said, getting back under his covers.
"I know it's for Stanley," Wallace said morosely. "She couldn't very well be driving my car."
"Did it break down somewhere?" Wallace waved the question away.
"Do you know Lena, the trapper?"
"Lena?
She's as burly as a man and wears men's clothes. She smokes a cigar."
Jamie knew who he meant, although he had not known her name.
"I've seen her. She's ugly as sin."
Jamie remembered her face well enough. Heavy and jowly, thickly browed, her nose mottled like pink granite. She was ugly, but saying so seemed cruel. Wallace went on,
"There's something so offensive about an ugly woman. An ugly man, that's unfortunate, but there still could be aesthetic interest there. An ugly woman is disturbing."
One late-coming dog was still wagging outside the screen door.
"Oh, for Christ's sake."
Wallace flung himself to his feet and let it in.
"There, happy?"
He lay back down.
"Last night, Lena was saying she's out with the rifle now, not traps. Spokane Fred was at the table. This was that boxcar place near Lolo. You know it?"
Jamie nodded, understanding Wallace meant a certain roadhouse to the south, cobbled together from two boxcars.
"You know Spokane Fred?"
Jamie nodded again. He had a passing familiarity with most of the dissolute gamblers around Missoula. They'd replaced Wallace's old friends from the university, the ones who used to come over and argue when Jamie and Marion were little, but had, at some unnoticed moment, stopped visiting.
Fred asked why, and Lena said because she doesn't like to get nursing mothers by mistake in the spring. Then this stranger who was in the game said, "Must be expensive to have a heart." And Lena said if the babies die now, she can't trap them later.
Jamie was too puzzled by the line of conversation even to feel his usual burst of aversion to trapping.
"Seems like more foresight than most people have. Is that where the car is? Lolo?"
Wallace stared up at the porch's ceiling, hands behind his head.
"Do you think if Marion were to become a pilot, she'd end up like Lena?"
"You mean ugly?"
"Yes, I suppose. Tough and alone, with a cigar stuck in her face. I imagine Lena's raw material was rougher stuff than Marion's, but Marion, I already have trouble picturing her in a dress. Can you imagine Marion as a bride?"
His laugh stumbled over itself, became a cough.
"We're only 14, Jamie pointed out.
"I know," Wallace said. "I know, it's not too late."
He propped himself on his elbow, looked at Jamie.
Maybe you could have a word with her. She'd punch me.
Wallace subsided onto his back.
You're probably right. I wish Barrett were still around.
He'd been late paying Barrett so many times, she'd finally taken a job for a professor's wife in a big house south of the Clark Fork, though not without shedding a few rare Norwegian tears when she embraced the twins goodbye. Before she left, she'd taught Jamie to cook a few things. He refused to cook meat, of course, but he didn't mind frying up fish if someone else did the catching and gutting. So Caleb brought trout sometimes, or Marion did. She got bread from Stanley's, too, and when the housekeeping money Jamie extracted from Wallace wasn't enough, she made up the rest. Jamie tended a vegetable garden modeled on the one Caleb kept. Sometimes a gift shop in a hotel downtown sold one of his drawings, though that money he put away for himself. He tried to keep the house clean, but because neither Marion nor Wallace seemed to notice or mind the creeping grime and disarray, he was gradually surrendering.
Barrett was always trying to get Marion to wear dresses, Jamie said. It's impossible.
Wallace didn't say anything but covered his face with his hands.
Wallace? I need you to do something,
Wallace said, his voice hollow against his palms.
I need you to tell Marion when she comes home. I can't do it.
Tell her what?
I lost the car.
What do you mean, lost it? Where?
I lost it. I bet it in the card game last night.
Jamie couldn't help himself.
Why? He burst out. Of all the things to bet.
Wallace sat up, swung his legs to the floor. His hands dangled between his knees.
I was winning. Well, first I was losing.
Then he'd felt his luck turn like wind knocking a weather vane. He'd won a small pot on three of a kind. Then he won again, kings, a bigger pot, and again on a flush. Besides Lena and Spokane Fred, there'd been a stranger at the table, a red-haired fellow in a swank overcoat with a fur collar. The stranger had pulled out a bottle of Canadian whiskey.
The real stuff, Wallace said, and poured a toast.
A lightness had come into Wallace.
I wasn't likely to win the next hand, but I knew I would, and I did. I knew I should lose a couple of times for form and get out of there, but I couldn't even lose when I tried.
The chips flocking around the table like wayward birds had homed for him.
Then this stranger said, "Wasn't I the uncle of the girl who delivered booze for Stanley?" I said, "I didn't know what he was talking about." He said, "You're Wallace Graves, aren't you?" He knew Marion's name.
Wallace paused.
He got under my skin. I started thinking about Marion, about how when you were little I only cared that you came home eventually and with all your limbs, but now I'm supposed to worry about her reputation. I should have left. I knew my luck was gone.
But he'd stayed and lost and lost and lost. Spitefully, sullenly, determinedly. He lost all his chips and several IOUs, and then he'd lost the gray Cadillac. The red-haired stranger in the fur-collared coat won it. The car was ancient now, the last remnant besides the house of the great winning streak of 1913, kept running only by Marion's devoted ministrations, and maybe that was why he'd allowed himself to bet it, out of vindictiveness. Because the car was the loss Marion would feel most acutely. Bad luck, Wallace believed, was no more than a kind of gloomy mood that welled from an internal spring, and Marion, the way Lena had reminded him of her, the stranger's unsettling mention, was the cause of his mood and therefore of his losing streak, too.
There is no money for another, he said.
He wiped his nose with his cuff.
Will you tell her? I need to go to bed now, but you'll tell her.
When Marion came home, Jamie dutifully told her about Wallace losing the car, absorbed her initial fury, stopped her from rousting their wretched uncle out of bed to be excoriated. She demanded why he wasn't angry, and he said they couldn't both rage.
"So if I weren't angry, you would be?" she asked.
"Maybe," he said. "I don't know." It was true they'd always been like two adjacent locks in a canal, one opening into the other, pouring off excess feeling, seeking equilibrium. Though she was usually the lock in danger of overflowing and he the one who absorbed excess, rose up as she sank down. People thought being twins made them the same, but it was balance, not sameness, she felt with him. That night in their cots on the sleeping porch, she asked, "Why do you think he gambles? We'd be fine for money if only he wouldn't."
"I don't think he means to," came Jamie's voice in the dark. "I don't think he can help it."
"You wouldn't think it'd be so hard to stop throwing your money away."
"I think he's after the thrill."
"What thrill? He never wins."
"And if he quits, he never will either. I think he likes to hope."
"Hope shouldn't be so expensive."
"You know he's sorry."
Marion's cot creaked as she turned over.
"Yes," she said. "He even cried a little when he finally stopped hiding from me. He kept saying he'd gotten into a tough spot. That's all he'd say.
He wouldn't tell me who'd won the car, just said a stranger." "Doesn't matter, does it? Better not to know. Maybe you'll see it around."
"Probably not, because no one but me would take the trouble to keep it running."
After a hesitation, Jamie said,
"The car was Wallace's, though. He owned it. He could bet it if he wanted to."
"But he bet it for nothing, for no good reason.
He was just losing something for the sake of losing it."
The next day, from her hiding spots in the cottage, she collected most of her flying money, earned bottle by bottle, basket by basket, and went into town and bought a used Ford from a mechanic she knew. He was a customer of Stanley's. His wife was a lush, and he gave her a good deal. People treated her differently now she knew their secrets. She informed Wallace that he could drive the Ford to the U, but if he was going out gambling or drinking, he'd have to walk or find a ride or buy his own damn car. If he lied, they both knew she'd find out. And she told him she would only pay $3 a week in room and board now. The rest would be his rent on her car. The sadness of the cottage, an emptied treasure box, outweighed the pleasure of the jaunty black Ford, her own wheeled and engined thing. On the bright side, her debt to Wallace seemed eased slightly, made bearable. She and Jamie might have been foisted on him, but Wallace had a way of acquiring burdens for himself, too. Without the twins around, he might have ruined himself long ago. Perhaps they had kept him just far enough from the precipice. The model airplanes hanging in the cottage had come to seem forlorn, the tender relics of a child's fantasy. Flight, the reason for all her labor, was almost forgotten as she worked to make back what had been spent. The money was slow in returning. Mr. Stanley's business had stagnated. The feds, desperate to make prohibition something other than a dismal failure, were cracking down. Stanley was being edged out, he hinted, by Barclay McQueen. Ever since the night of Barclay McQueen, Marion had made her deliveries to Miss Dolly's as swiftly as possible, never venturing beyond the kitchen.
"What are you so sore about?"
Belle wanted to know when Marion refused to be dressed up again.
"We only had a bit of fun. No one touched your pure self." "I'm not sore," Marion said. "I've got a lot of stops to make, that's all."
She wasn't sure what she was, but it was bigger than sore. When she thought about Barclay McQueen, her skin tickled, her pulse accelerated, her guts felt pulled in different directions. At night on the sleeping porch, sometimes she thought about Caleb kissing her, pushing her shirt off her shoulders. But lately, her mind had been veering away to McQueen. How he'd pinned her against the wainscoting with his gaze. How he'd asked, "Who are you?" She took a second job, making deliveries for restaurants in the Ford. Barrett's son, Sigga, who'd become a prohi, came by the house once and warned her that Mr. Stanley was going to get raided. She tried to give him what money she had, but he brushed her off. "I'm not crooked," Sigga said. "I just know you haven't always had it easy." The feds found only bread and cake at Stanley's. A hot day in June. Caleb showed up when she was outside tinkering with the Ford's engine. "I'm going for a swim," he told her, leaning against the car. "You can come if you want." He put on his most charming smile. "You can even give me a ride if you ask nice." "Jamie will be home in an hour," she said. "He'd want to come too." Caleb was looking at her the way he did before he named the price of a haircut. "I don't feel like waiting an hour." She thought about lying, saying she had to work, but she knew she would just sit around being regretful after he left, ashamed for not having dared. He was watching her, waiting. He took out a silver case full of hand-rolled cigarettes and lit one for each of them. "Fancy," she said about the case. "I took a rich guy hunting," he said. His eyes were still on her. He knew she was scared. "Fine," she said. "Let's go." She drove them west out of town, turned south where the bitter route wound in tight bends through flat land. Caleb whistled as they rattled along. He took a flask from his pocket and offered it to her. The moonshine burned her throat. She winced, handed it back. "You need a haircut," he said, reaching to touch her neck with one finger.
"I'm fine for a while," she said, tipping her head away.
She parked among the trees, lemony sunlight in the branches. As they walked toward the water, Caleb said, "Is Jamie going on with school next year?"
"Why don't you ask him?"
"I haven't seen him lately. I'm always gone." Caleb had been spending more time in the mountains, sometimes alone, often as a hunting guide for men who paid him to find the game, to take the shot if they missed and pretend he hadn't. Marion had bought him a good rifle, and he had paid her back even more quickly than promised. People talked about him, the 17-year-old kid who knew where the animals would be. They talked about the serene deadliness with which he shot. It helped his business, he'd admitted, that Wallace had always been after him about his grammar. He spoke well.
"Then we should have waited," Marion said.
When Caleb didn't reply, she asked, "Do you think Jamie's soft for not hunting?" Caleb thought before he answered. "Last time we went fishing," he said, "we met some kids who'd covered a dog with a blanket and were throwing stones at it. I had to stop Jamie from killing the kid who didn't run fast enough. So no, I don't think he's soft." Marion remembered. The dog lived with them now, creeping after Jamie like a temple slave, watching him from beneath tables and beds. The boy had needed to go to the hospital. Jamie was lucky the kid's father had a grimy past and no interest in involving the police. Otherwise, Jamie might have been sent to the correctional school at Miles City.
"I think I was levitating," Jamie had said. "I was so mad I could have killed that kid, and I wouldn't have felt bad at all. I wanted to kill him."
"You taught him a lesson," Marion had said.
"No, I didn't. Some people are rotten inside, and the rottenness will never go away."
They came to the river's edge, to a pool sheltered from the current. Caleb shed his clothes out in the open, but Marion went behind some trees. Privacy lay only in speed. Naked, she sprinted for the water, trying to cover herself with her hands. A whoop burst from her as she splashed in. Stones bruised her feet. She crouched, breathless from cold and anticipation, her teeth chattering. Caleb was standing in water up to his chest, his arms moving in broad arcs under the surface, as though he were smoothing the sheets on a bed.
he came toward her.
He'd been holding the flask underwater and offered it to her now, dripping. She unscrewed the top, coughed from the cold moonshine. Caleb tipped his head back, submerging his long hair. His clavicle strained against his skin.
You know, I went to see one of Miss Dolly's girls. I saved up.
She tried to hide her urge to recoil.
Why would I know that?
I thought they might have told you. Why are you mad?
I'm not mad.
Which girl?
Belle. Marion didn't mean to make a face, but did.
What?
Caleb said. She's the prettiest one.
She's just...
She wanted to say common, as though she were a snobbish character in a novel. But what authority did she have? Here she was, naked in a river with a boy.
She's just what?
Nothing.
Did you tell her you know me?
Yeah. She asked if I was the one who cut your hair, and I said I was.
Marion was outraged.
Why did you tell her that?
Why shouldn't I?
She didn't know exactly. She said,
I'd think you wouldn't want to go to whores.
Why not?
You know why. I wouldn't have thought you'd want a drink either.
Don't talk about my mother.
They stared fiercely at each other, chins in the water, lips purpling with cold.
Sorry, she said.
She saw him decide not to be angry. He turned sly, said,
Belle taught me things.
What things?
She said it was good to know how to make a girl happy, but if I want to be happy myself, I'm better off just going to see her. She said other girls will just worry about being proper and won't be any fun.
I'm not worried about being proper, she said before she'd thought.
He smiled his pocket-picking smile.
You want to make me happy?
No.
Marion had no real word for the part of her that had come alive, was tugging at her attention.
Twat,
Miss Dolly's girls said.
Twitch it, they said. Peach, bits, clam. None of these seemed quite right.
She said,
What things?
You mean, what did she teach me?
Marion nodded. He moved closer, backing her into shallower water. He leaned down and took one of her breasts into his mouth. The sensation was more strong than pleasant. The completion of a circuit. They were standing together, their torsos out of the water, him bending to his task. She felt his erection. She watched, fascinated, the place where her flesh disappeared into his mouth. He did not quite devour like the beast with Gilda, was gentler, deliberate. He was the one to pull away.
Did you like it?
I don't know.
She couldn't admit she had. He kept moving toward her and she kept moving away, so they traced a circle in the water.
Belle told me Barclay McQueen liked you and Desiree got jealous. Is that true?
What if it is?
Do you know who he is?
Of course I do.
Are you going to let him do things with you?
I'll probably never see him again.
So you would let him?
The idea of Barclay McQueen touching her seemed absurd, fantastical.
It's a silly question.
So you would?
They were standing still now. He looked serious, worried. Like he was going to ask another question, but instead he said,
I don't want you to be my girl or anything.
Was he telling the truth?
Good, because I don't want to be your girl.
Just fun, then, he said.
Underwater, his hand swam toward her, but she stepped away.
I'm cold,
she said and got out, feeling his eyes on her backside but not caring. She dressed without drying off, went back through the trees, drove away. She didn't worry about leaving him alone so far from town. One place was as good as any other to Caleb. At night in the bath, she studied her breasts, one now so much more experienced than the other.
tiny red pinpricks visible around the nipple where his mouth had left a bruise. A July afternoon flaring and fading into evening. Marion knocked on the back door of a house near Paddy Canyon, up at the end of a long, narrow track cut through forest. The house was handsome but not large, freshly painted green with white trim. It had no close neighbors. She had not made a delivery there before. Barclay McQueen opened the door. She could only gape at him. He wore a white shirt and black waistcoat. One corner of his mouth turned up. He said, "Hello, who are you?" She couldn't read his tone, whether he thought he was asking her for the first time or whether he was alluding to Miss Dolly's hallway. "I'm Marion Graves."
"So this time you have an answer,"
he remembered. Of course he did. "I've got a delivery."
"Let me."
He took the basket from her. 4 bottles of Moon. He'd only ordered them so she would be sent to him. That much was clear. It was herself she'd delivered.
"Come in and I'll pay you."
"I'm fine to wait here." Through the open door, she saw a red-haired man sitting at a kitchen table, reading a newspaper. He glanced up, went back to reading. She had seen him before, around town.
"Come in," Barclay said again, amused, "or I'll complain to Stanley about his bottle man's favoritism, paying visits to Dolly's girls, but not to me."
Confounded, she stood where she was.
"This is Sadler," Barclay said of the red-haired man. "He doesn't bite. Are you sure you won't come in? Don't you want to see my house?"
Sadler was watching her, smiling faintly, coolly. She said, "What's so special about it?"
"Only that it's mine."
"Seems like it'd be a lot of work to see everything that's yours."
"You've been listening to gossip." "Fine. Wait here."
He disappeared briefly, came back with the empty basket. Shutting the door on Sadler and his newspaper, he said,
"I've been spending more time in Missoula, and I don't like hotels, so I thought I should have a place."
He drew a gold cigarette case and lighter from his pocket and sat on the edge of the porch, black shoes splayed in the grass. He patted the planks beside him.
"Sit for a minute. Do you smoke?"
She sat. "Sometimes." He lit a cigarette for her, ready-made, not hand-rolled, then his own. She noticed his hands were lightly freckled, the nails clean and carefully trimmed. She thought of Caleb's cigarette case, Caleb at her breast. Caleb was not so unlike this man, but less controlled, less formed. Caleb's nails were bitten to the quick.
"I've just come back from Chicago," Barclay said. "Have you ever been there?"
"Only on a train when I was a baby."
"Have you ever been outside Missoula, excluding infancy?"
"I've been to Sealy Lake,
and my uncle took me to Helena once." "But not outside Montana."
She shook her head.
He said, "Well, Montana's a good place, as good as any I've seen."
"I want to see other places."
"Elsewhere is overrated in my experience."
"What places have you been?"
"Oh, lots."
"Outside America?"
"Yes."
"Have you ever been to the Arctic?"
"No, thank God. It sounds terrible."
He saw her reaction.
"You'd like to go? You don't think it sounds lonely?"
"I wouldn't mind." He had a crooked smile, higher on one side.
"I've had enough of being lonely, I think."
She nodded, at a loss for what to say.
"Aren't you going to ask why I'm lonely?"
"All right."
"So ask."
"Why are you lonely?"
"It's a chronic condition.
My father sent me away to Scotland, where he came from, when I was very small, to a cold, dark, dismal school run by cold, dark, dismal people.
Dark in terms of their souls, not their skins, which were extremely white. I've always been considered a curiosity. Brown for a Scotsman, ghostly for a Salish. My mother is Salish. Did you know that?
Underneath his careful ease, she caught an almost imperceptible quiver of nerves, like fishing line gone taut after a bite.
Yes. You've been asking about me?
No, she said too forcefully. I heard it somewhere.
He seemed amused. That must mean you know my name, even though, rudely, I haven't introduced myself.
You're Barclay McQueen.
What else do you know about me?
You have cattle up north.
What else?
You're a businessman.
What kind of business?
She looked him full in the face, dragged on her cigarette. The tobacco was milder than anything she'd smoked before, but also richer. Cattle, like I said.
What else do you know?
Not one thing.
You understand discretion. That must serve you well in your business.
A sidelong glance.
The bakery business.
She smiled, looked away to hide it. He said,
what do the girls at Miss Dolly's say about me?
Frightened but bold, she said, they say you like everything just so. He had a rough, barking sort of laugh.
That's true, I do. Why shouldn't I? Everybody should know what they want.
His eyes moved over her face.
Marion Graves, what is it you want most?
No one had ever asked her such a question. To be a pilot, to be a pilot, to be a pilot. Telling him would be so simple, would require only 4 words. But she said, I don't know.
Sometimes too much discretion becomes a hindrance. When she didn't reply, he said, if you won't tell me what you want, then I can't help you get it. And I do want to help you.
Why?
I like your face. He tossed his cigarette to the ground and pressed it out under a polished black shoe. Would you like to know what I know about you?
Almost in a whisper, yes.
Your father was the captain of the Josephina Eterna and was sent to prison. Your mother was lost. You and your brother were sent here to live with your uncle, Wallace Graves, who is an excellent painter, in my opinion, but a drunk and a very bad gambler. Are you impressed? I know you aren't yet 15. I know you're a good driver and mechanic, and that you're Stanley's bottle man, bottle girl. Stanley seems to enjoy the novelty. You are a sort of flourish for him. He has style for a small-timer. And you don't steal and you don't talk. As to why you haven't run into more trouble with feds or the like, that's partly down to luck and partly down to lawmen being lazy and corrupt. And for the last few months, it's been partly down to me.
She tried not to show how startled she was.
All because I like your face, he said. Even now, when you're disguised as a boy, however unconvincingly, I like it very much. There's something Shakespearean about your appeal. You won't know what I mean.
You mean Twelfth Night?
And As You Like It, and The Merchant of Venice. I thought you didn't go to school.
There are other ways to learn things.
That's true.
She stubbed out her cigarette on the sole of her boot, tossed the bud away. Her nervousness had given way to a gathered, deliberate feeling. She knew, without knowing how she knew, how he wanted her to be. Amused, aloof, a little tough. She was aware of the sharp edge of the porch against her fingers, the way he watched when she stretched out her legs. He went on. What I couldn't entirely understand at first was why you would drive for Stanley. For money, yes.
But most girls your age aren't so compelled by money that they leave school and indenture themselves to moonshiners. And since your brother is still in school, the impetus can't have come from your uncle, or else he would have made your brother leave too and go to work. How am I doing? All right. All right. Good enough. So I'll give you some of my hypotheses and tell you my conclusion, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Watching her, he said, I thought maybe you'd taken it upon yourself to help your uncle with his debts, of which he has many, and more all the time. But I never heard about you trying to pay anyone. So then I thought maybe you're after thrills. Otherwise, why would you have let Dolly's girls dress you up like that? You like being disguised as a whore, as a boy. This isn't a disguise. It's practical. He smiled briefly, indulgently. Or I thought you might be saving up to run away, but then you bought a car and didn't go anywhere. So I concluded the car wasn't it. There was something else you wanted to buy. And then it came to my attention that you'd been haunting the airfield. I made a few discreet inquiries and discovered that, yes, you'd been hanging around and pestering the pilots for lessons ever since Lindbergh's flight, which makes it 2 years. But no one will teach you. She hadn't expected him to be so methodical in uncovering her deepest wish. She hadn't known it was something that could, with enough patience and persistence, be excavated. That must be frustrating, he said so gently, for someone who wants more than anything to be a pilot. She was afraid. This fear wasn't her earlier keyed-up nervousness or the jitters she'd felt in the river with Caleb. Not ordinary anxiety, but an inarticulate dread. Some primal resistance to the thing that roiled between them. I don't want to be a pilot, she said. It was only something that got into my head for a while. I thought it would be a lark to learn to fly. I wish you would trust me, Marion. A bootlegger I met in a brothel? She meant it as a joke, a leavening. But she had misjudged. His face closed. I'm a rancher, he said quietly. That's important to remember. An owl glided overhead. It flapped in and among the trees and disappeared. Barclay watched it, scowling. His shift in mood made her uneasy. She wanted to be back in his good graces. She said, I was tired of school and wanted to make some money. Wallace never wanted kids of his own, but he took us in because he's good-hearted. There was no one else. I wanted to pay him back, that's all. Help out. But what do you want for yourself, beyond this ambition to help out? I don't know. Nothing. The usual things. He leaned toward her. I don't believe you one bit. She was aware of his maleness, the breadth of him, the sureness with which his black shoes were planted on the ground. That scent she'd noticed at Dolly's, some kind of hair oil or perfume, bitter and musky. She wondered how old he was. Couldn't guess. 28. His crooked smile swung up again. In your research, did you learn I was only 19 when my father died? I came home after 1 year of university in Scotland. He left everything to me, the ranch, but also the responsibility of taking care of my mother and my sister, and very much to my surprise, quite a lot of debt. I thought there must be some mistake. One of the largest landholders in the state, a man who made a performance out of being pious, temperate, living well but not extravagantly. I couldn't understand how he could have been in debt until I started going through his papers. Mismanagement, that's all it was. The simplest thing in the world, trusting the wrong people, bad investments. He dug in deeper and deeper until he dug himself into a nice deep black pit. Fortunately, he relocated to a literal pit before he could dig us under any further.
I couldn't bear to tell my mother. In the end, I didn't have to. It turned out I had a knack for identifying opportunities, and this was 8, 9 years ago, a time of great opportunity.
The early days of Prohibition. He looked at her to be sure she was following.
I got us out of the hole and then I kept working. I wanted to be sure I'd never be back in it. I found the men who'd ruined my father and I ruined them.
The crooked smile.
Not that they knew it was me.
I prefer an indirect approach.
He grew abruptly somber. I'm saying this because I want you to know I understand what it's like to be burdened by someone else's mistakes when you're young. I know what it's like to be underestimated.
But being underestimated can be an opportunity, Marion, if you know how to take advantage.
Do you see?
In her experience, being underestimated hadn't gotten her anywhere, certainly not behind the controls of an airplane. But she said,
I think so. When I first saw you, I don't know how to put it. I recognized you as someone I needed to know. You fascinated me. Otherwise, I wouldn't have.
He broke off, scraped moodily at the grass with one heel.
I meet girls all the time. Ordinarily, I forget about them right away.
If you were just another one, I would have forgotten about you already, too.
I thought I would. I waited for you to go away.
Instead, you're always here.
He tapped his temple with a finger.
Just from that one glimpse.
Do you ever think about me?
At the memory of when she thought about him, how she thought about him, she flushed.
I have to go. She stood, took the basket.
He reached out, grabbed her leg just below the knee through her trousers. His grip was strong, like the jaw of an animal.
Marion, all I want is to get to know you, to be your friend.
He recovered himself and let go, looked up into her face.
Here's a piece of advice, now that we're friends. If you're giving Wallace money, you might as well throw it in the river. I've looked into what he owes. He won't ever be able to pay it off, and at some point, it'll all come due. But I could help.
She longed to ask exactly what Wallace owed and to whom. His debts seemed to her like a dark well she was forever peering into, listening for the splash of a dropped pebble.
She said, just because I was dressed up like a whore doesn't mean I am one.
His expression did not change.
Remember, you can always come to me.
She'd had no reason to be curious about the house when she arrived. But on her way out, she paused, contemplating its separate green and white garage alongside which she'd parked Stanley's truck. The structure resembled a miniature barn, wide enough for two cars, with sliding doors padlocked shut. There were two small square windows on each long side, and she thought if she found something to stand on, she could see in. She was curious what Barclay drove. She'd seen bootleggers' cars around here and there, powerful Packards or Cadillacs or Studebakers, whiskey sixes, and she'd heard stories about souped-up engines, false floors and hollowed-out seats, armored gas tanks, flanged wheels for driving on railroad tracks and across trestle bridges. A bucket and a wooden crate had been left beside the garage, and she stacked them and climbed up, cupping her hands against the window. Inside was a car she'd seen in magazines but never in person, a gleaming black Pierce Arrow Brougham. Long and low with wide running boards, swooping fenders, white wall tires. A silver archer on the hood pointed its arrow at the oncoming world. All her confusion about Barclay was, for the moment, supplanted by a longing to lift that hood and look at the 8-cylinder engine underneath. A wild impulse seized her to go knock at the door again and ask if she could see the car. She knew Barclay would comply, would maybe, perhaps, even let her drive it. But then she would already have begun to owe him. She was so enraptured that at first she didn't notice the second automobile on the far side of the Pierce Arrow, in the shadows, mostly covered except where the tarp had gotten hitched up in front, showing a bit of gray paint and a bumper she knew well. "I don't want to make deliveries to that house anymore," she told Stanley. "Someone else can do it." Stanley looked weary, his hair white with flower dust, his big hands clasped over his apron. He'd been making money hand over fist since the Volstead Act passed, but Marion had no idea what he spent it on. He lived in the same house as before, worked every day in the bakery. His wife wore ordinary clothes. He must be stashing it all away.
"You gotta," he said. "He asked for you specially. He didn't try anything funny, did he? Because if he didn't, you gotta. Do it for me, all right? I've taken a lot of chances for you, put a lot of trust in you. He'd ruin me in a heartbeat if he wanted. And he asked for you specially, okay?"
What could she say? She could only remember one other night when she hadn't been able to sleep. The night her father came home. She had lain awake on the porch while Jamie slumbered on the other cot. He'd been as anxious as she was, maybe more so, but somehow he'd managed to drop off. So only she had heard their father's voice, low and indistinct. Only she had seen his shape in the cottage window when he closed the curtains. In the moonlight, the tall grass between the house and the cottage had looked tipped with silver, like the fur of a wolf. For the almost 5 years since then, she'd slept easily every single night.
"You're a genius for sleep," Wallace said.
But now she lay awake again, thinking about Barclay McQueen, listening to Jamie's breathing. An odd longing for her brother came into her. How is it possible to miss someone who was asleep just there, on a cot across a narrow gap, almost close enough to touch? But at the same time, he seemed impervious, irretrievable, like something glimpsed from a moving train, already receding into the distance. Barclay McQueen. When she closed her eyes, she found herself looking through Gilda's window at the beast, through the window of Barclay's garage at that bit of gray hood. Why did he have the car? To worsen her lot? To take something from her? Or would he offer to return it as part of some future bargain? Jamie would say she should have nothing to do with Barclay. He would say he had a bad feeling, and she would struggle to explain that she had a bad feeling too, like she was in a river being pulled toward a waterfall, panicked but also violently, recklessly curious. In her cot, she pressed her heel against the bruise Barclay had left when he clutched her calf, felt a dull pain, and sharper pleasure. She threw off her blanket, pulled on her boots, slipped from the porch. There was a moon, nearly full. She walked sure-footed in the dark to Gilda's cabin. Nothing happened when she tapped on the window of the tiny closet where Caleb slept, only a ripple in the reflected moon. He must be in the mountains. No light at Gilda's window, either. But when Marion turned to retreat home, she saw a shadow on the grass. Caleb was sleeping outside on a bedroll. No fear in her, only a daring indistinguishable from necessity. She dropped beside him with the urgency of a soldier entering a foxhole. He startled awake, but she put her mouth on his before he could speak. He relaxed. He understood. She stripped off her pajamas, and he made himself naked in a single motion. He had always seemed like a person on the verge of nakedness. He rolled her onto her back. She felt his penis poking against her, nosing around, wayward. And then hard pressure, heat, a dull sawing. She observed the pain and strangeness with detachment. Observed the way his black hair slid over his shoulders, the rise and fall of his hips between her knees. She imagined Barclay's hips, Barclay's shoulders, Barclay's breath against her neck. She didn't know what to do with her hands, so she pressed them to the grass. It was over quickly. She had not felt pleasure, but she did feel relief. She stood and dressed. "I still don't want to be your girl," she said, looking down at him, stretched out in the moonlight like a slender basking cat. She knew this was the truth. Barclay had made it true. His teeth glowed.
"Don't flatter yourself."
She poked his ribs with her foot. "Ass," she said and started for home, drowsier with each step. In the morning, for the first time, her monthly blood. Missoula, September 1929, 2 months later. "At the airfield?" Marion said, looking at the delivery list Mr. Stanley had given her.
"Special order, gent called Marks," Stanley said.
"I know everyone at the airfield, and no one's called Marks."
"He's been vouched for."
"By who?"
"By someone who's good enough for me, and so's good enough for you."
When she arrived, a couple of pilots were sitting on oil drums outside the general office, leaning against its corrugated side, drowsing in the sun. The afternoon sky was deep blue, undiluted by cloud. If she were them, she would be up flying. She called out the truck window, "I'm looking for Marks." They stirred.
"Yeah, the new guy," one said. "Try the hangar down at the end."
The other one said,
"Got any free samples today, Marion?"
"I've got some day-old buns."
"What about something that comes in a bottle?"
"Depends. You want to take me up?"
"Depends."
She drummed her fingers on the steering wheel. "I've got to go see this Marks first." The pilot shrugged.
"I might have gone home by then."
She drove down to the newest and largest hangar. Inside was airy coolness, grids of smoked glass windows. At the far end, big sliding doors had been rolled open onto the field, and the bright rectangle of light was sliced across by the long orange wings of an aircraft, nose pointing out, black fuselage sloping down to an orange tail.
"Hiya."
A man was sitting in a camp chair under the port side wing reading a newspaper, his feet propped up on the bottom rung of a stepladder.
"You must be Stanley's famous delivery girl."
"Who wants to know?" Letting the newspaper flop across his lap, still with his feet propped up, he regally held out a dirty hand, large for his skinny arm, with broad fingertips like a frog's.
"Tough guy, huh? I'm Trout Marks."
"Marion." She balanced the basket on her left hip and leaned down to grasp his hand, gripping firmly, thinking wistfully of Felix Breyfogle. This man was remarkably ugly. No mystery about the derivation of his nickname. His mouth was downward bent and almost impossibly wide, more like a grouper's than a trout's, really. When he spoke, he revealed a yellow saw of crooked teeth. The rest of his face offered little compensation. His eyelids were droopy, though one more than the other. His ears were short, scooped tabs stuck to the sides of his big round head, and he was entirely bald. But he had a calm, cheerful way and a goblinish charm. Marion said, "Nice ship."
"You like planes?"
"Yes."
"Been up in one?"
"A few times."
"Ever been at the controls?"
"No one's ever given me the chance."
"No? Why not?"
No need to explain the obvious. She set down the basket and walked under the wing, looking up at the smoothly varnished fabric. The plane was new enough to still smell faintly of bananas, a chemical joke played by one of the solvents in the doping.
She closed her eyes, inhaled.
You look like you're smelling a bunch of roses, Trout said.
Better than roses.
She circled around to inspect the silver propeller and grease-blacked sunburst of engine cylinders. Her gut feeling was that if she played her cards right, he might take her up. She had to be careful not to say anything to make him brush her off as just a kid, just a girl.
What's the make on this?
That's an upgrade. Pratt & Whitney Wasp. 450 horsepower.
Top speed?
They say 140, about. But I've done faster and it didn't catch fire or nothing. Those lights were custom. Good for landing at night.
Do you do a lot of night landings?
Some. You seem to know a thing or two about planes, don't you?
I read a lot.
That's so. What do you read?
All the flying magazines. What's in the newspapers? Books? She was